Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. I'll be joined here shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow, having a little bit of a technical issue, but hopefully we'll just kind of try to work through it. Tonight, we are going to be joined by a special guest, Tommy Root, our resident insurance, trucking insurance professional. And also joining with him will be Joe Hodelmeyer. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And we'll be getting to those gentlemen here in just a second. But in the meantime, we're going to start the show off as we normally always do, and that's with the DAT Trend Lines report for this week. So we have this week, diesel fuel prices have went down by 0.5 percentage points. We're showing that the national average is sitting right at $3.65 per gallon nationwide. And spot rate looks to close the year at record highs. Following the volatile freight market in the first half of the year, punctuated by the polar vortex and road check week, the second half of 2021 has seen a lot more seasonality, albeit a much higher altitude. Load posts on DAT load boards are currently at 51% higher, 51% higher compared to the same time week last year. The same 51% higher compared to the same week as last year. So year over year, it's 51% higher. And almost tripled the volume since 2018. Spot rates for all three equipment types combined are 16% or 44 cents per mile higher compared to the exact same time as last year. Taking a look, a deeper dive to see exactly how the spot rates were performing last week, starting out with the dry vans, we're going to look up into the upper northeastern corridor. We're showing that the average outbound spot market rate for dry vans checked in at $2.61 per mile. Dropping down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate for dry vans at $2.73. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing that the average outbound spot market rate was $3.16 per mile. Moving down to the south central region, we're showing that the average outbound rate was $2.62. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast for dry vans, we're showing that that average rate was at $3.38 per mile. That leaves the nation. Shifting gears, jumping over to the flatbed portion of the report. Starting out in that northeastern corridor, we're showing that that outbound spot market rate for flatbeds checks in at $2.94 per mile. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing that the average spot market rate for flatbeds comes in at $3.14. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound rate of $3.29. That leads the nation for flatbeds. Dropping down to the South Central region, we're showing that the average outbound rate was $2.88. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $2.81. Shifting gears and jumping over to the temperature controlled or reefer portion of the report, we're showing that that outbound spot market rate checks in at $2.97 per mile out of the northeast. Moving out of the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing that the average outbound rate at $2.85. Coming in out of the Midwest, we're showing that the average outbound rate for reefers at $3.82. That leads the nation ever so slightly. Dropping down to the south central region, we're showing that the average outbound rate was $3.10. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing that the average outbound rate was $3.79 per mile. And with that being said, I'm going live. The mic is hot. I'm hoping that this is my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Chuck, is that you? Wait a minute. Wait, I hit the wrong button. Let's hit the right button. Chuck, is that you?
That's me, Rico.
All right. I have my fingers crossed. Yeah, I have my fingers crossed. Like, hey, wait a minute. But we got everybody up. We got everybody up and on board. Tommy's here. Joe's here. And wonderful. With that being said, I wanted to ask you before we bring our guest in, how are things been going this week for you guys up at Traffix and up north of the border there?
Well, you know what? It's like you alluded to, and you know, in what you were saying, how we're ending the year. It's busy everywhere. I've never seen so much freight in my entire life. It's a good problem to have.
Those are good. Yeah, I was just going to say, those problems that we want, that we like problems like that.
Well, we've had it where there's
like problems like
even, you know, since we've been doing this show, we've had a lot of times when there were a lot more available trucks than there were available loads. We've all seen that. And right now is one of those times when there's just not enough available equipment for the number of shipments that are available. So it's a great problem.
Absolutely. So with that being said and without any further ado, I want to go ahead and welcome our special guest in for the evening, Mr. Tommy Rook. Tommy, are you there?
I'm here, brother. Yes, sir. Both of you.
All right.
Hey, how are you, Tommy?
To talk to you again.
Always a pleasure.
And I hope I'm not butchering it, but correct me if I'm wrong. Joe Huddlemeyer of Motor Carrier Insurance Foundation. Let me grab him as well. Good evening, Joe. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. Help me out if I got
it
wrong.
Rico.
Nope, all right, all right.
Glad to be here.
Well, glad to have both of you guys on. I got to start this. First of all, I want to welcome both of you on. I got to start this with a question. There's been a lot of hype in the media lately, and I realize some of it is just hype with allowing 18-year-olds to cross state lines. And I realize that really, 18-year-olds have been driving tractor trailers since there was tractor trailers, and in some cases it's some young person living on a farm in South Dakota or Iowa that drives the family tractor trailer from the farm to the mill in town, which is 12 and a half miles each way. And they've been probably doing it for, since they were 14 years old. And we all know that goes on. Now, all of a sudden, our administrations in Washington are going to allow these 18-year-olds to cross the state line, which is great because I do understand the void of new drivers coming in. I understand it better than anybody, only because I feel it every day. But how the heck are we going to get insurance as an industry for these young people? It's great that we're going to hire young interstate drivers, but who the heck is going to insure them? Joe and Tommy, any ideas?
Yeah, Chuck, it's not going to be all that complicated because when you look at requirements, first of all, there's only 3,000 in this pilot program, and the restrictions are once they have a license, they got to have 400 hours of school, they got to have 200 hours on the road with a trainer, they got to have a speed limiter, they've got to have anti-braking, they have to have all that equipment. The only people going to do that is the larger fleets who are self-insured, who are accepting the first $1 million. And their carriers will look at, the insurance carriers will look at that with that training program. The real advantage that we got to think about for everybody, you and everybody else, now what's going to happen is they're going to get 2 years experience at the expense of these motor carriers who do this. But now every insurance company says we want to risk with 2 or 3 years experience. Now they're going to have the experience at 21 and 22 versus 24 and 25. So it's going to open that up, Chuck. And at that point, Joe, you can. I appreciate your comments because you've been on the right all your life. That's going to be more acceptable, do you not, the 22 or 21 or 22 with 2 or 3 years experience?
I think that as long as – I think the big requirement has always been 2 to 3 years driving experience in life,
right.
Make, model, equipment. So I think that it will be more accessible. But, Chuck, you're right with the concern. You're not going to get an insurance company to insure an 18-year-old that's just going into a truck on his own. And the small guys,
right.
Like Tommy said, aren't going to be able to afford to do it.
No,
it's going to be the ones with large retentions. That's what's going to happen. Go ahead.
So it makes sense what you're saying with a pilot project of 3,000 people. But if it works, I guess if they can go to the large, as we used to call them, I don't know whether they still use that term, mega carriers, and get trained there, because those are great training grounds, no matter what. They're big enough to offer proper training and give great experience. They have schools. And then, after these people have driven for 2 or 3 years, by the time they're 21, we've got a bunch of great drivers on our hands.
Go ahead, Tommy.
No, I said at least ones with experience on that. And they've also the big fleets, Chuck, have something that person with 2 or 3, half a dozen trucks, even 15, 20 trucks, don't have the varying type of operations, because these larger motor carriers can put them in locations where they go out one day and come back the same day.
Sure.
Can put them in places that they're – and they got their own dollars there as they build it. And it's also going to be like the NFL football teams who have cheap quarterbacks until they get the big salaries. The cost of this driver isn't going to be the same as the seasoned interstate driver. So there is an economic benefit if they can get some productivity out of this worker, this new driver, as he or she develops this kind of experience. So there is an advantage to them to do that.
Well, yeah, because there's a huge void to fill, from what I understand, and anybody on the show can correct me, they're talking about a shortage of 160,000 truck drivers at this rate, where we're going through them now, by the end of 2030. So we've got to get them from somewhere.
Yeah, that's the number we're hearing too. And a pilot program of 3,000 isn't going to make a dent in that. But I do think if the pilot programs prove successful, then you're going to have that number increased. And the big push is to get these guys coming out of college, coming out of high school, before they get into another trade, and then
right.
It's too late for them to get into our business.
Right. We've seen that for decades. You get a 21 or 23-year-old even, and he or she, by that age, already has – they've taken another path because we couldn't get them near the truck.
Exactly.
So that
when they get 21, 22, they've got some tenure at the other job, which then gives them a solid income, and they're not – it's tough to leave that to go on the road. And you've still got the problem with the home style and wanting to be home and things like that, too. And the motor carrier who take this pilot program and take these 3,000 are going to have to address that part of it, too. But there's probably less these more singles at that level than they would be more with the kids and things like that, that kind of hurt somebody who's young to get in the over-the-road trucking. I mean, this is where you've seen this, Chuck. How are you bringing your drivers home more often now? Are you not?
Yeah, well, you know what? The home time is huge with drivers now. The whole idea of drivers staying out for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks at a time, that's gone the way of the dodo bird. People don't want to do that anymore. You don't have the amenities on the road. Home time has become very important. Everything is just, it's all changed. And I think one, and we've talked about it on the show before, I think one of the biggest game changers besides for drivers' demands for more time with families, like people don't want to be gone for 6 weeks at a time, you know, running from coast to coast and then down and up and everywhere else. That life is just not there anymore because there's so many other great jobs driving truck where you can be home every night. You know, it's gone the way of the dodo bird. On top of that, trucks have become way too expensive to be used as hotel rooms for 10 hours a night. They're just that's an expensive piece of real estate when you start using it as a hotel. So that's the
other. Yeah, you got to keep it on the road.
Yeah. You know, you're buying a piece of equipment that, you know, by the time you spec it out, I'm sure if you could buy a truck right now, a decent truck, it's not far off $200,000. No, I'm in Canada,
right,
so it is $200,000. Rico, you're down on the other side, on the U.S. side. How much is a new, if you could buy a new Freightliner or one of those trucks, not a real expensive Kenworth or Peterbilt, how much is it now down in the U.S. for a new one?
Here lately, I haven't priced a brand new truck, but I tell you, when I was looking at them before, the equipment crunch, they were running in the ballpark of $150,000, $160,000, and I can only imagine that being closer to that $200,000.
I know the big fancy Peterbilts and Kenworths are more than that, but the Volvos and go ahead.
I visited with Rush Trucking, which is one of the largest. They have an insurance arm who are members of their foundation in preparation for the annual conference. Just talking about all this new equipment, all, and they said the price, the minimum is $150,000, and this was in October. In September when I visited. But they're averaging for anything that's not totally fancy, but just the minimum stuff is $170,000,
$175,000. That's one expensive hotel room. Be using for.
I got a question.
10 hours.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chuck. I got a question. I'm a curious question since the equipment prices has jumped up. So with equipment prices and everything jumping up the way that they have, and say people that already have insurance on their trucks, I mean, because you know we got a lot of guys and girls that are listening, smaller carriers, and they may not have. I'll take myself for example. I have a 2015 Freightliner. I paid about $32,000 for it. But now that same truck on the open market right now, that same truck is running anywhere. I've seen similar models to mine with more miles on it going for $65,000. How should people handle handle that right now, dealing with insurance and dealing with tractors that they already have currently on their policies?
Well, two things I would suggest, Rico. The first is at the renewal. Let's just talk about it's the renewal time. They got to realize that. They got to realize that they just don't want it the same price as before or a little less, because if it gets a total loss, they're not going to be able to replace it. They're going to be completely out of business because the policies that are written in 90% of the time for truckers that we're dealing with say the most we'll pay is the limit or what it's worth. And so whichever is the least. So if it's worth more than the limit, the insurance company is going to stroke a check and take the salvage in a lot of the cases and finish the claim. And so there's a very vulnerability to that. They need to think about this midterm, because your example right now, if you had a crash tomorrow, and let's say it's a crash that in time, but the insurance company wants to get rid of it, so they're going to stroke you a check for your limits at $45,000, that number $45,000, and then they're going to take the salvage and have some ability to recover some of their money back out of that salvage. So they need to think about that. They need to talk to their agent about the value, and they need to talk to a dealership and get them to at least say, what's it worth? Most of the as you know, Rico, you can go to a dealer and ask them, what's my truck worth? Happens all the time, and they'll give you some ballpark figure, will they not? You know, dealers that you're used to dealing with, dealers?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that's what they got to start thinking about, because they could be put out of business because of that wreck.
Tommy, should our listeners be going, because we're in a crazy market. We haven't been in a market, I guess, as far as truck prices, maybe ever. So should our listeners be going by a dealer every 90 days to get an idea of what the increased value of their tractors and their trailers are and report it back to the insurance company?
Well, they're gonna have to think about, because it's gonna cost them some. It's gonna do upward of the premium, because the premium is a function of the limit. But
right.
they've got to think about that, because it's extremely vulnerable. They're very vulnerable for being put out of business if they're not. And so the headlines today on the transport top, I've gotten the mail today, front page, used truck. Used Class A trucks price break records in October.
Yep.
That was the headlines today. In transport topics.
It's true.
This week's.
Yeah, we're seeing
so
crazy prices because. Yeah.
Joe,
and,
you
and
have underwriting. How
we,
would you, how?
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. No, I say, how would you look at this, Joe?
Well, first thing, I mean, we've been beating up on our members, telling them to make sure that they're looking at the values of their insurance, because the last thing they want is for the last thing the retail agent wants is for there to be a claim, and then they've got to explain to their insured why they're only getting 60% or 65% of what the value of the unit is. I really think most motor carriers, like you said, Chuck, every 90 days, I mean, that might be too often, but I would say minimum every 6 months, you know, as long as the prices keep going up. And with the chip shortage and the limited availability of units and the number of new entrants new motor carriers into the marketplace, the unit values are going to stay up just because of simple supply and demand.
Oh, yeah, 100%. They've got to clear up the backlogs first, which is going to be a couple of years, just to get all the parts that are required to fix the stuff that's sidelined right now.
Exactly.
You know, I'm hearing stories.
The underwriters are not going to – they'll be happy to raise the rate. Now, granted, the premiums are going to go up, like Tommy said, accordingly. But,
of course.
But you know, I mean, it's just it's good business, you know. And these guys,
well,
they have to
have
understand.
It both ways.
Yeah.
Right. So, let me just ask you a question: What would be the difference in most policies? Let's just say, and we'll use Rico's truck as an example. If we have Rico's been insuring his truck for $30,000, the replacement value. Now he's found out that it's $60,000. How much will his insurance go up to buy that extra $30,000 worth of, really, it's replacement or physical damage insurance? It's not liability.
No, it would probably, if you went from 30 to 60, it probably would double, because the rate is a function of the value. And if there's a rate of, say, 4% on the vehicle, it would be 4% of $30,000 or 4% of $60,000.
Oh, okay.
So it's going to be...
So if Rico's paying... So it's not that if he was paying $12,000 for his insurance, he's not going to start paying $24,000. He's probably going to be paying about $13,500 or something.
And it would be prorated how much time left in that policy term,
right?
3 or 4 months. And there is some faction at the renewal time, the bigger the dollar, sometimes the rate will go down based on that larger dollars. But, and Joe, I don't know what the current marketplace is doing that way, but typically the higher the limit, the less the rate is per 100 or per 1,000.
Right. Yeah, there's some break. It's not that big a break anymore because the repair costs are so high now.
Right, yeah. Right.
So are insurance companies writing off trucks a lot quicker because they're too expensive to repair when they're involved in a wreck?
You mean making total them?
Yep.
Chuck, I haven't talked to an adjuster about that. That's one that we're actually going to do a class in Phoenix. I'm going to ask an adjuster that. But typically, yes, the adjuster wants to do it. And what has happened is what I talked about before. Not only the truck could be underpriced, but there could be things there that are salvageable because some of those components now on these wrecks are very valuable, the chips and all this stuff. So if they can then total it, take the salvage, and then sell the part, that will make them even quicker to total it because they're going to write a check as soon as they can. And a total loss is what the truck the total loss is if the repair of the truck is the same or more than the limit, the value of the truck less the salvage, but no more than the limit. So as long as the salvage goes up and that's up too, then it's better to also total it. And now with that gap, I mean, I promise you that if Rico's truck, those numbers he gave us right now, those things, had a wreck that would be fixable. Front end collision, this comes. They're going to total it. They're going to write him a check for his $35,000 or $40,000, get out of Dodge, salvage the part, and recover what they could.
Okay. Interesting. So, gentlemen, let me ask you something. Tell us what's going on as far as new markets, because, you know, the last time we had both you gentlemen on, there look like there may be some new entrants into the U.S. market. What's going on now? As far as
Joe, you answer that, then I'll put my two cents after that part. Okay, go ahead because you stay abreast of this pretty close.
Chuck, in all honesty, we're hearing of three or four, maybe five potential new entrants to the marketplace, but they're not up and running yet. And a lot of it is a function of just getting their rates and forms approved in the states. It's a slow process, and it's funny because I guess over the last 6 months, I've talked to five, six different new potential markets, but they're slow to come on board. And like I said, what you're going to see is you'll get a new market that'll come on board and it'll be operational in three or four states because it's taken them X amount of time to get approved, to get their rates approved in those states. I think we're going to see some new entrants. I think they're going to be very, very, very selective. I don't think we're going to see, the void filled for new entries as far as trucking. Yeah, new ventures are still going to be tough, but I think if Tommy's probably going to expound on this after I get done talking. You know, when you have trucks with all the technology and the data capturing abilities that there is now, most of the new markets that are coming in, they're being built to take advantage of that data, so they can justify their pricing and they can write a better risk for a better price.
Chuck,
sure. Makes sense. You know,
I have.
Funny guys.
I have seen.
Funny how quickly.
Go ahead.
No,
I'm sorry. I don't want to.
I was down at your annual convention a couple of years ago, and the word in there was, it's funny, the insurance companies haven't even began to mine the amount of data that's available to them. That was 2 years ago. And look at them now. They're right in there taking advantage, which I think is wonderful. That's going to help everybody.
But the thing that the blister is going to have to hear They've got to be willing to share that information. That's going to be a key
to
a sound program in the future. And I'm talking about people with one or two trucks. That will prove to them that and give that data, the printout, go to a third-party app. It's cheap, you know, $180 a year can per truck. I know two or three of these programs of that kind of range that tracks all that stuff. And that will go furnished to the underwriter to show that they are operating within the standards. And for the fleets, how they're using it to train their drivers, you know, and school their drivers. This is the thing. Joe, there's that program out of Phoenix and program out of Oklahoma. Both of those are up and running, and they have seemed to write a lot of business lately, have you not, from what you've heard?
Yeah, I'm seeing them write more. Again, it's very, very, very selective.
I agree with that.
And it's very regional.
Right. There's cool three in that part. But what I find, and again, I like Joe because he's got an underwriter hat forever. He's underwritten for 50 years, I guess. Or Joe, I'll put your age on this part of it. Forever, like I've been teaching forever. But anyway, I see a chasm or a gap between the trucker who is paying attention to CSA scores, has the technology, willing to share it, versus and has no really aggressive violations, meaning speeding, falling too close like that, versus ones who are not paying attention. I think that gap's getting greater, getting broader, because these new markets want to write good business, and the price is up now enough they think they can make money. And the older and the market's been there for a while are looking at better risks now and trying to clean some of that bad business up to justify where they are, and they tend to make a little money. Most of the reports we're seeing, they are close to breaking even, if not making a little bit in this year. They're going to try to write and keep those, but they're getting a chance to look at a lot of business with these new ventures and marketplace, and they'll have a year or two's experience was now going to get into the first dollar market, and so they're going to be more selective. So if the motor carrier doesn't pay attention to those kind of things, I was asked on a Road Dog radio show about a month ago about how the insurance underwriter looks at it from a crash or a CSA score. They'll will drop a risk quicker for bad CSA scores than it will a crash.
Right, because there's a ongoing behavior or pattern of behavior. That's not acceptable.
Right, exactly.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Right. We're in a business to pay for crashes. You know.
Yeah.
If they don't
really,
have crashes,
you know, I have a theory.
We don't have any business.
Right. I have a theory, and I'll share it with you. You tell me if I'm right or wrong. But I always tell people that insurance companies are gamblers, and they're betting that you're going to do things right. And if all they want to do, they want to make money on, they want to place good bets. No different than one of us, any of us going to the horse or, in your case, because you guys are in Florida, the dog races. And do you see it the same way?
Definitely.
Absolutely. Joe, you put the programs together. You can put them and tell them how they look at the people who put these programs together for you.
Yeah, I mean, what you have to do is, and data is the king, and data will always be the king, you know, and it's no different than the odds makers, you know, looking at, you know, if you're talking about a football game, you know, okay, the offense does this, the defense does this, is their strengths and weaknesses. Basically, that's what an underwriter's doing. An underwriter's really looking at the same things. They're looking at tendencies, they're looking at past experience, they're looking at how they've done in the past. And like Tommy said, you know, having a loss, you know, we're in the business to pay claims, and you expect losses. You don't expect the frequency of losses, and the way to minimize the frequency of losses is to make good bets. And that's pretty much, I mean, it's, you know, you would get insurance executives at the highest level that if you said what they do is gamble with investors' funds, they probably would have a stroke right there. But but really, Seriously, but really, you know, basically what you're doing, you're taking an educated bet, you know, that you're picking right, and that's how you make money or you lose money.
Well, and
Joe,
you know,
I think you just came up.
What's that, Tom?
No, I think Joe came up a better analysis. It's when you handicap or set the odds at a football game or a baseball game or even a horse racing, because you're taking the history and taking what they've done before and say, will they repeat themselves, and take who they're against and will they repeat themselves and come up with a probability. This is what they're doing. So, yes, that's gambling because we don't know the outcome, but it's a calculated based on the performances or the information they have.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I had a conversation the other day with one of our terriers, and the guy's been in business, I would have to say, for 15 years, and good operator. He did have a crash last year, but he's worried about it. Nothing, he wasn't charged, and it was down, actually, I think it was down your neck of the woods in Florida, but the other part over by the Panhandle. And he's worried. He was wondering what would happen if he bought another trucking company and that had a good clean record and just kind of like started operating out of that one as far as insurance. Would his insurance automatically go up because of the wreck he had with this company if he stopped operating that company?
And the short answer is probably. Because
okay.
What they check, Chuck, is ownership of companies, because that's in CSA data, and they check the VIN numbers of vehicles. And if that new company used a truck that the old company used before on the old company's VIN number, they're going to want to know why. And so they're going to find out how they merged together. And so you're better off up front.
Yeah, they're probably going to end up paying more if they start a new company, because the underwriters are going to think that they're trying to pull something over on them, that they're trying to fraudulently lead them in a certain direction. And trust me, they'll get caught, because like Tommy said, there's too much information out there now not to get caught. Plus, if he goes and basically starts a new company, he's going to be a new venture. And if he buys a new company, then people are going to ask the same questions. They're going to say, why? You know, why, if you had a truck line, did you buy a new one? And the past will follow him, but he'll look a whole lot worse because it's going to look like he's trying to pull something over on everybody.
I try to explain that this world is not right. The world's way too transparent to be doing stuff like this, and he'd have a problem with his customs bonds and his CTPAT and all that stuff that they have to cross the border. But it just probably wouldn't be worth it.
Now, if he bought it and merged it into his old company, and kept operating that with new ownership, then that's actually more acceptable, and some of that past history, the company he bought, if it had good record, that would be considered as long as the operation is carrying over, particularly the good drivers and that kind of stuff. That would be the better way to go, Chuck.
Okay. He's probably,
so
if he's not listening, he does listen to the show, sometimes not live, but he does listen to it. So we've answered a question for one of our listeners there. These markets that are developing, when do you think they will start insuring? But would you think beginning of next year or not that quickly?
Oh, no, I think pretty soon. I mean, like Tommy said, there's a couple of them that have started in the last 3-4 months, and I think we're probably going to see another two probably up right after the first of the year. But the new companies, you know, when you look at the number of new motor carriers that are entering the marketplace, and then you look at the premiums that are available, you know, most of these, they can't write an unlimited number of risks, and most of them have limited
right.
capital, where they might only be able to write first year $25 million. Well, with prices where they are, $6,000-$7,000 a power unit for liability, another $3,500-$4,000 for physical damage on a unit, another $2,000 for cargo. It doesn't take much to get to $20-$25 million. And some of these have caps in the $10 million range. And you know, for a startup, you know, for they're trying to prove themselves to the investors too. So, you know, the investors aren't going to give them too much rope. They're not going to say you can go out and write $100 million the first year. So it's going to help the marketplace because of supply and demand, you know, if there's more people out there willing to write it. But like Tommy said and like I said earlier, you know, they're going to be so selective that probably 60-65% of the motor carriers out there are not going to qualify, you know, for the new programs,
Chuck,
because they want so much information.
Chuck,
and because they're new carriers, they just can't provide that that much data?
No.
Is that why they won't qualify?
No. Well, yeah, they won't be willing to commit in the data and the lane they want to go through, what territorial requirements of ELD information and those kind of things. But without going too deep, insurance companies are limited to how much they can write by states, by the state governments,
right,
because of the percentage from their assets. They're also limited to write because most of these new ventures are heavily reinsured, and the reinsurance companies are only going to let them write so much. And that's,
yes,
and Joe brought the third one up, and that third one is the investors there. So even the new ones will go slow and will cherry pick fit within their model. The couple that we are knowing about that I'm actually involved in some of it is tied into using data, and actually they won't write anybody that doesn't give them access to the data.
Why, you know, why should they? As far as I'm concerned, you know, I look at my insurance company, they're my partner. They're a real important partner.
Right.
And in order to be a good partner, I need to give them all the information so they can make decisions and I can make decisions. And if they called me and said, you know what, Chuck, you're running, we're real uncomfortable with you running into this particular area, I can have a choice. I can make a choice at that point whether I want to go back to the customer and say, listen, that area is really bad, and my insurance company is going to raise me or just decide that I'm not going to run into that area. I think that's very fair. And, you know, that's good business. You need to know what – you do need to know your risks. You can't run around in this business with your eyes closed because somebody will poke them out real fast.
And, Chuck, you were the type of insured that I wanted to insure, somebody that I felt was a partner. I mean,
that's
good business. It's good business for both sides.
Yeah, you know, go ahead, yes. Yep, Tom.
Well, what I was going to say, Chuck, a lot of times, though, you have some people who are listening to us or some of the good old boys' attitude. They're worried about the government. They're worried about the intervention. They don't want to share that stuff. They got to change. That's the point.
If they don't change, they're
going to have to change.
Well, they have to.
They're going to be able to.
You know what? This is not 1975 anymore. We're in a whole different,
right.
You know, we're in a whole different thing, and you can't be running three sets of paper logs and all the other stuff that was done years ago. You know, you just can't be doing stuff like that. You know, I was in an interview last week, and there was a husband and wife team, and the wife said, well, I don't drive much, but he uses my book, and like my hours. And I just said, well, don't ever. If we give you a job here, if we ever find out that's happening, you're both fired. We will not tolerate that. I said, because the worst thing can happen to us is a wreck, and the person that's driving is supposed to be sleeping. The person that's sleeping is supposed to be driving, and we're not interested. And anyways, they took a job for one of our competitors running to the West Coast, and God bless them, because I don't want to be part of it. But those are the things that used to go on, as we all know, and I wouldn't dream of doing that to our insurance company or to the public or to our company.
Well, what, While we're on the subject, and we have you gentlemen on, and like I say, most of our listener base are small guys, maybe one or two truck Charlies, and there was a real big push right before ELDs came into effect for people to go out and buy older trucks that didn't have to have the ELDs and stuff of that nature on the trucks. Let's take a minute. Instead of, you know, we don't want to necessarily browbeat those people, but let's take a second to maybe educate them to talk about why, because you were talking about the information, having the information available in order to qualify different things for insurance. Maybe let's try and educate them and tell them the benefits versus, you know, talk more about the pros versus the cons, and maybe see if we might be able to have a come to Jesus meeting with some of these people and convince them to maybe they should consider coming into the modern era of trucking.
Joe, kick it off.
I'm posing that to you guys, Tommy and Joe, as far as the insurance is concerned, with being able to speak to the downfall of trying to maintain or keep an older truck where, you know, the 2000, I think it was, a, what, 99 to 2000 or pre-2003 model truck on the road and not having to have the ELDs and things of that nature. Maybe from an insurance perspective, are those trucks going to become uninsurable? Or what do you guys predict coming down the road as far as that type of stuff is concerned?
Well, the trucks are not – those trucks will still be insurable, Rico, but they're going to be paying a whole lot more in premium for the insurance. And as a result, the savings that they're getting, you know, that they think they're getting, where they don't have to take care of – you know, they don't have to have a current unit with ELDs, it's going to more than offset it, and it may drive them out of business. I mean, that's because – everybody, you know, we're seeing more and more of the big commercial transportation carriers that are requiring the ELD data from the engine module and data from the dash cams and the event recorders. And, you know, the more current technology you have, the cheaper your insurance is going to be and the more available options you're going to have as far as insurance goes. Tommy, is that pretty accurate?
Absolutely. I'll go back and quote your partner there, Rico, Chuck. It's a partnership, and they want to trust. And if you're not willing to be transparent with the trust and show this stuff, then that starts a negative. And the worst thing an underwriter can be is negative, because they're negative enough already. trying to convince them of that part of it. And I even think that, you know, a lot of underwriters will run because the first thing they're thinking about is that trucker's trying to cheat, and I don't want to be involved in that part of it.
Yep.
And that's just the mentality of the underwriter and you know, the why. And I think Chuck hit it on the head.
And I take offense to the point that Tommy said that underwriters are negative enough.
Well, you know what? I can understand an underwriter going in, looking at a file, looking at a company, him having some questions and not being sure, and a little man inside him goes, this doesn't look like a great opportunity for our company. And that underwriter is thinking, is this worth risking my career?
Amen.
No, I don't want to risk my career over this guy. He's got 1991 long nose Pete's, a bunch of cowboys strutting around. No, I'm not interested. This is too risky. And, you know, the other thing, and I heard this recently from somebody in the insurance business, and we were talking about that. Because they asked me when they did our interview how old trucks were, they want to see a list. And they didn't say, you know, the
the older trucks had to go, but they had to, everybody has to be on e-logs. But what they did say to me was, you need to remember that the worst thing that can ever happen is we're in front of a jury, God forbid.
Amen.
And all that happens here is, well, what year was the truck that hit the school bus? It was a 1991. Ladies and gentlemen, this was a 30-year-old truck, 30 years old. And they bring in some expert, Bill Fedorowicz, who's some sort of an expert. How many miles does a truck do a year? Well, they average 100,000 miles. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that's 100,000 miles for 30 years. That's 3 million miles this old truck has traveled. And then the brakes went and hit the school bus. And you know what? The company sunk.
Yep.
And that's part of the reason that the insurance companies now, somebody said to me, the actual trucks, are the new ones, are no safer in a lot of cases, other than some of the manufacturers have really gone overboard, and they've done a wonderful job making trucks creature comfortable, safe, you know, the ergonomics, side airbags, front airbags, all sorts of wonderful stuff. So those are definitely safer. If they aren't equipped with disc brakes, they're no safer than a 30-year-old truck. But it is the, number one, it's the paper logs, and you're allowing somebody the opportunity to not fess up how much they're driving. And that's a huge issue, I think, for most insurance companies. Would you not agree?
Most definitely.
Absolutely. So, you know, that's where I think people, we all know that those old engines were really, really reliable. We didn't have any of the challenges with diesel particulate filters and putting DEF in them and everything else. And but I think, you know, in the last 10 years or 13 years, whenever, since 2008, I think that they've done a much better job in bringing these products up. And I think they're a lot more reliable now than they were, you know, even 7-8 years ago. So I don't think there's as much to worry about with the newer trucks as far as their reliability.
Chuck, I would only phrase that. I totally agree with you. However, some right this minute with a shortage of chips, that's, you know, that's a problem too right now. But
yes.
Also would point out that some of these new trucks with the, and I understand the difference in the disc brakes and the old barrel brakes, but some of the new trucks actually have more of the technology on it for crash mediation, lane change, and this kind of stuff. And I think underwriters, even for liability, are going to start looking at that once there's enough data to show which one of those types of equipment has actually reduced crashes.
Tommy, I couldn't agree more, because it protects them from a loss. Anything that's going to protect the insurance company from a potential loss, they're going to, and rightfully so, they're going to think it's a darn good investment.
Chuck, it's
right,
on, that on your school bus instant, Chuck, you know, where the truck hit the school bus, you know, you're going to get a plaintiff's attorney that's going to say, did you have lane mediation? Did you have this technology? And then they'd have an expert on and say, how much would this technology have cost? And the guy would come in and say, $1,000. And then the plaintiff's attorney is going to say, Mr. Trucker, so it wasn't worth $1,000 for you to save the lives of these 15 kids. And not going to be able to defend that one in court.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, there was a Canadian case about 2-3 years ago in Saskatchewan where a driver went through a stop sign and killed 16 young boys on a hockey team and severely injured a whole bunch of others. And some were left in, you know, quadriplegic and some paraplegics. And it's just a nightmare. Driver had very little experience. It was just a disaster. And it just showed all of us how quickly pardon my language on the air, but shit happens, and it can happen to anybody. So we all need to do whatever we can, and if there's $1,000 piece of technology that you can buy that's going to protect you and the public, I think you should probably get it.
Yeah.
It's well worth it.
And that's what we want to avoid. We have an underwriter that boils down how he looks at something, Chuck, and you just talked about this. He tells us and shares with some younger underwriters and agents, when I look at a risk, my first thought is, can I defend it in court? If I can't defend it in court, what they're doing and the equipment and how they operate and this kind of stuff, I'm not going to write them. So that's where now we're starting with the nuclear verdicts and all that. This is the place they're starting.
Right.
So,
and will it?
I'm looking at the time, and it's going kind of snuck away and got away from us. We have blown through that hour.
Did we ever?
So I always like to try to give our guests an opportunity to tell our listeners where they can find them, if you have any social media, anything of that nature, or just website information, anything like that. So I'd like to open up the floor, turn the floor over to, we'll start off with you, Joe, and then we'll finish up with you, Tommy. Tell the people where, if you'd like to share your information on where people can get in contact with you, where they can find you, the floor is yours to do so.
Our website is mcief.org, mcief.org, Motor Carrier Insurance Educational Foundation. Tommy and I can be reached by tommy@mcief.org and joe@mcief.org. So, it's pretty easy to get in touch with us. We are available pretty much all the time. Now, don't call me on Christmas. I won't be around. Tommy doesn't have a life, so he might be around. Tommy, I'll turn it over to you.
Joe and I are the same, Rico. Joe and I are the same thing. The only thing I want the audience to understand is we have nothing to sell. We're not for profit. We're just there, and our passion is to share information to motor carriers so they understand their insurance and become better insured, which means they're safer. So any questions they have, ask us. We get coverage questions all the time. If they have a problem with a claim or something, we can help sort that out, at least explain to them how it's happening and why things are happening. And we have a number of attorneys and all that we can refer them to that will give an answer and get through the queue to at least give them something short and give them some guidance. So we have nothing to sell. All we want to do is give information and make the trucker better. That's my passion, and Joe's passion is to help the trucking industry.
Well, we share that passion.
And we appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys.
Well, we love
We appreciate you guys taking time. Yeah.
So generous of you.
So Chuck, my friend, you are up. You are up last. Tell the good folks how they can get in contact with you and where they can find you, and we'll get ready to find a hole to bag this thing into.
Okay. Well, if anybody needs me, they can call me at extension 203. That's really important. It goes through voicemail hell, unfortunately, and the number is 1-800-388-4353. 52, again, extension 203, or just reach me on email. It's just chuck@traffix.com. You can send me a private message on Instagram at Chuck Snow, CEO. If you're going to email me or send me a private message, if you want to include your phone number, it's quite often easier for me to call you back. And if you're looking to get set up with Traffix as a carrier, I'll take you by the hand and introduce you to the right people for what you're looking for so that you can make some money. And with that, Rico, I'm going to let you back it in the hole.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, once again, this has been the Rates and Lanes podcast. We appreciate you, the listener, for taking time out of your schedule as well to come and hang out with us for a little while. We're always eternally grateful for you doing so. You could have been anywhere else in the world, but you took a little time to hang out with us. We're grateful that you did. To our guests, Joe and Tommy, for coming on, taking time out of their schedule to help inform our listeners. We definitely appreciate it. And until the next time, we want everyone out there listening in to stay safe, stay healthy, keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise, and God willing, we'll talk at the same time, same place next week. God bless you and good night.
Catch you on the flip-flop. God bless.
Good night.